You're listening to a repeat of the 96FM Opinion Line. Phone and text lines are now closed. The Opinion Line with PJ Coogan. 1850-715-996.
Glorious summer's morning across Cork City and County, and it's going to be a lovely, lovely warm day. Might be a day to have the dinner out in the back this evening. If you have a table with a glass top that you bought at Argos and is called Sicily, listen up. I have a story from the UK that might just apply here that you might be very interested in. That's during the morning. Argos Sicily garden table. If you have such a thing, listen up. I'll be going back to it during the morning. 1850-715-996. Text 083-396-9696. The email for the show, opinion at 96fm.ie. The 12th of July, a controversial day north of the border. Coming up also this morning, an email from a soccer fan asking a question that is infuriating some listeners on Facebook. That's all to come. But yesterday, towards the end of the show, we started talking about the death penalty. And we very rapidly went from the death penalty to the Eighth Amendment, to the Ten Commandments, to Irish water. The only thing we didn't get stuck into yesterday was a few vaccine conspiracies, just to throw them into the mix. It was all a very interesting end to the Opinion Line yesterday, but it prompted Lisa to contact us. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, PJ.
You were listening about the death penalty in particular.
I was, PJ. I heard a bit of it yesterday. I was working at the time. But, I just wanted to voice my opinion on it. I would be 100% for that, PJ.
What, bringing it back?
Yes, bringing it back, PJ. I think in this country that we're living in, it's a living disgrace. There is no law and order in this country, no justice for people that are harmed, people that are murdered. I mean, I think it's a living disgrace in this country.
It was done away with here. The last death penalty was for the murder of a Garda in the course of their duty. That was done away with, I think, in the 80s.
Well, PJ, I think it definitely should be brought back, and being honest.
For what, though? Not forever.
Well, for serious crime, PJ. For the likes of people, take, for instance, now, PJ, an old person that's murdered in their home.
Yes.
I mean, that to me, as you know, I spoke to you before about a case in Ballysagret, PJ. That to me is a horrific crime. I believe somebody that does that to somebody, their life should be taken.
Right.
That's the way I feel, PJ, about that. You know, there's many other instances, I'm sure, that people themselves should think of would be brought back for it. But for me, that one would be the most. And also, unprovoked attacks where there's children. You know, one case there, there's a boy, I'm sure you remember it many years ago. He's in a vegetable state in a nursing home now, PJ.
Yes, I do.
I mean, I'm
Dennis,
sorry.
Dennis, I think, was his name.
Dennis Franklin, yeah.
Franklin, he's from Limerick, that. Wasn't he?
He yeah. was, he was from
Is
Limerick.
He's still alive.
He's alive, but he's a vegetable in a nursing home, PJ.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that always struck a chord with me, what his parents were left behind to deal with. I mean, 4 years was handed down inside the courtroom for the person that did that to that man. I mean, the judges as well are a disgrace for what the sentences that they're handing down. I don't read The Echo anymore, PJ, being honest with you, because it's just a disgrace when you open the pages and you read what they're getting off with. Mm. I mean, suspended sentences, files being sent to the DPP, you'd ask yourself, what next?
Well, the judges, and I'm not defending the judges, but the judges can only go by the law as laid out in front of them.
Oh, they can. But PJ, I'm sure if they have elderly parents themselves, and if they have somebody in front of them that's after brutally murdering an old person, that they can hand stiffer sentences down. I mean, come on, in fairness.
So the murder of an elderly person, you say, that should carry the death penalty. Murder of a child, I presume?
Oh, yeah. Definitely,
okay. PJ. Would it have to involve a murder, Lisa?
Well, for me, PJ, a murder anyway, you know. But for other people, they might have other reasons for it. Mm. But, like, as I spoke to you there about Dennis Franklin now as well, that, to me, 4 years sickened me.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, PJ, as we said, you know, we run about the commandments, thou shalt not kill. But
yes.
It's also in the Bible, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth.
Yeah, but you see, the only thing about that, Lisa, is, and there's an old saying, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. If we lived like that, we'd all be blind and gumsy.
I know that.
You know, we don't do revenge. Are we sure the state shouldn't do revenge?
So, PJ, I know that I'm a law-abiding citizen, believe me. But if it would come to my child, PJ, being harmed, an innocent child or an elderly parent of mine, I'm serious. I would take the law into my own hands, PJ. I would have no choice but do it. I would not leave it go to a court because the sentence that would be handed down would do nothing for me. It would absolutely do nothing for me if my child was harmed or an elderly parent of mine. That's just the way I am, PJ. I think that's the way it should be.
Bring back
I believe if somebody harms somebody, the same thing should be done to them, PJ.
Okay.
Just my opinion on it.
Hold on there, so Lisa, till I bring in Dan, because I think he's been...
Yeah.
Morning, Dan.
Good morning, PJ. Good morning.
Do you agree with Lisa?
I totally 110%, to be honest with you. I think they should, you know, if you're up for murder and you go in, right? I think they should bring in harvesting.
Harvesting?
Right, two for two, die for eye. If someone needs a transplant, whether it's a kidney, a lung, a heart, it should be taken out of them to repay. And that's been quite honest with you this morning.
So you execute them and then you harvest their organs?
You wouldn't have to execute them if it's a kidney wanted, or a lung wanted, or a liver wanted, because they'll have no more use in society.
So you'd make a living donor out of them?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I believe exactly what Dan is saying. I'm 100% with Dan.
Because, I mean, said the elderly and the young, I mean, said if you kill a guard, you're in trouble. But the elderly should have the same rights, and the young should have the same rights.
Yeah.
Exactly the same, 110% on that.
Yeah. So and you'd say if someone... Say, and Lisa raised the case of Dennis Franklin, and if any of his family or friends are listening, I wouldn't want to be upsetting any of them, but just say, take the case of Dennis, that someone, that person, that perpetrator should have lost a kidney or lost a lung or lost an eye.
Yes, pay back the society. If they're really remorseful, and if they're not remorseful, still take it anyway. It's
definitely, 100%. 100%.
They're no more good to society. They're vicious and they're evil.
Yeah.
You know? Evil people, yeah, exactly. Evil people, they should not even be on the face of the earth. That's
my opinion. Take them out of society, lock them up, and take them, transplant them.
I'm kind of knocked back at both of you. Not so much yours, Lisa. There's a lot of people who do believe in bringing back the death penalty. There's a lot of people who believe it should never have been done away with, and no matter when you bring it up, it's a divided argument on either side of it. But... So I certainly haven't heard of that one, Dan, only in some kind of strange science fiction novels.
I've heard of it, yeah. Well, there was some life in America, actually. I was watching television there some time ago. And there was actually someone on death row, and he actually donated his kidneys.
Right.
You know, and why not bring it in legally? Take them to the society, and they should never be left out. In America, they're locked up. And you know something else, PJ?
Yeah.
If you rob a bank here or a post office, you'll probably get 15 years and you'll serve it.
Yes.
But you'll kill somebody. You might only get 3 or 4 years. Maybe 7 years.
Yeah, Dan.
Most.
Exactly. That's what I was trying to get across as well, actually. You know?
Take the money, and you'll be dealt with severely. Kill somebody and look, you'll be left out after a few years.
Hmm. Yeah.
That's the way it's gone.
And should a death have to be involved, guys, for the death penalty to be imposed?
Sorry for cutting across, Dan, there now for a second, PJ. But can I just say one thing? Just take Cork City, for example, okay?
Okay.
You walk into Cork City, you're met with winos falling around the place, okay? Heroin addicts punching each other around the road. This is what I've experienced now a few weeks ago walking into town, okay?
Okay.
Dropping my mother to St. Augustine's Church, where she'd go to Mass every day. Inside in the church, a man stands up, tackles the priest with a bottle. I mean, PJ,
during Mass?
In the world? During Mass, PJ, this is not my first time experiencing this. This is my second time. But where in the world would they put up with that? A poor priest, defenseless, standing on the altar until one man was brave enough to stand up. My sister was there on the same day, actually, with her two young kids. She actually got up and left the church.
And were the guards called?
I don't think so, PJ. I'm being honest with you. Because a lady said it, that the guards are sick of coming here and they do nothing when they come here. She said they just put them outside the door and they're left outside the door. But I mean, to see a priest, PJ, at this, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's just got beyond the joke.
The law is very lenient in this country. You can do what you want.
Yeah.
But don't rob a bank and don't rob a post office. You'll be helpless if you do that.
You mentioned winos, people with a drink problem. What would you do with them?
Well, PJ, I don't mean the death penalty for the likes of those, obviously. but I'm just saying the state of Cork City. I would actually feel safer walking the Bronx, PJ. The Bronx was cleaned up years ago in America. Cork City, how many streets is in there? In fairness, you have Patrick Street, Oliver Plunkett Street, you have the South Mall, you have a few side streets, and it's a disgrace in there.
There is a couple of side streets down there. You daren't walk down there because they're waiting down there, you know?
No, I'd feel safer in the Bronx with my children and myself to walk the streets. My daughter would often ask me, Mom, can we go to town today? Once in a while I would do it, and what I'd experience in there, I wouldn't be enticed to go back there again.
I just go to the break because I want to bring some people in. I want to think, I want you to think about a question before I do that. Frank has put up a text to 083-396-9696 and he says the judge in the case of the Guildford Four said if it was available, he would have applied the death penalty back then. We all know what happened with the Guildford Four. Stay there, Dan and Lisa. Sharon wants to talk to you. So does, is it Maureen or Maren? I'll get to it next anyway. 1850-715-996.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world. Cork's 96 FM.
The Big Drive Home with Wayne Hilton. Cork's 96 FM.
Bring you the very latest Cork news from around the world, trending celebrity news. If you're out and about, all your essential Cork travel news, then I could be giving you the best news as I make lots of €1,000 cash calls. Join me weekday afternoons from 4 as we go home together and play Cork's biggest hits with the best variety.
Wayne Hilton, weekdays 4 p.m.
With the new Peugeot 3008 SUV, European Car of the Year 2017. Never has an SUV gone so far.
Cork's 96 FM. Call the Opinion Line.
This is what you came for.
1850-715-996. Cork's 96 FM.
So talking to Lisa, who wants to bring back the death penalty, and to Dan, who wants to take it a step further than that, and for serious assault, serious crime, when you don't have the death penalty, that they might be able to take your kidney for someone who needs one, or your liver, or a bit of your liver for somebody who needs one, or an eye. Basically, harvest your organs for those who need them. That would be Dan's form of justice. Sharon has called the show. Morning, Sharon.
Morning, PJ.
They're listening to you.
Right, well, first off, straight off the bat, I am 100% totally against the death penalty.
Why?
Okay? Well, like you said there now earlier, okay, you had the Guildford Four. The judge would have imposed the death penalty in that case, and we all know that case was a load of crap. They were innocent, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there have been so many cases, you know, with the whole Innocence Project and all this, where people have been proved to be innocent when they're on death row. Now, what I would do if, you know, somebody gave me a magic wand and it was up to me, I would say, right, life should mean life,
yeah.
Okay, with hard labour. I don't care if they have to dig the same hole for 30 years. That's what I would do.
Life without parole.
Yeah.
And hard labour.
Absolutely.
We used to call it penal servitude back in the day.
Well, I mean, no, I'm not saying for petty crimes or anything like that, but for serious crimes. Mm-hmm. Serious, violent crimes. Okay?
And what about Dan's idea to harvest organs out of people?
So you can do that when they're dead.
So, PJ, can I ask Sharon a question there, please, before
I go to my network? Yeah.
Sharon, I was just wondering there, now, just say when you say serious crime, okay? I'd consider a serious crime a murder of an elderly person. Just say, God forbid, being as my mother or father or yours. Would you not like the death penalty imposed on that person?
No, I wouldn't.
No?
I had an uncle who was murdered.
Yeah.
And the person who did it...
Yeah.
Was sentenced to 7 years with 4 years suspended, okay, for pleading guilty to manslaughter. The judge thanked him for saving the state time and money for pleading guilty, and he was released after 22 months, and I still don't believe in the death penalty.
I'll be honest with you there, no. I don't believe in the death penalty either, but I'd like to keep him alive for harvesting. Keep him alive for harvesting, girl. But what about that old man? Was that owner Mayo there some years back there where he tied up this elderly gentleman? The shop owner retired. The man in his 80s tied him up and he was found dead by another
And the poor man in Ballysacker as well, Paddy Lyons, God rest him.
Yeah.
That's right, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, for somebody that's caught, and it's proven beyond any reasonable doubt that a fellow or a woman is child with mother. And
how many people have been proved beyond a reasonable doubt and then been found innocent through forensic science?
She has a point there, Lisa. There's lots of people who were convicted, and if the death penalty existed, they'd be dead, and then they were found afterwards to be innocent. What would you do in that case?
But PJ, as I said, other people would have other reasons, but my reason for it, as I said to you, would be the murder of an elderly person or a young child, unprovoked attack.
Yeah, but that doesn't answer the question that I'm asking you. What if we subsequently learn that that person didn't do it? They're dead, then dead.
But PJ?
Well, I don't know much about the Guildford Four. I didn't read much into that.
Basically, they'd be dead if there was a death penalty. They didn't do it.
Oh, I know they didn't do it. I know that.
But they'd be dead if there'd been a death penalty. Do you understand that?
Release somebody from prison.
I do understand it, but it wasn't imposed on them, PJ. So, you know, they were released after all those years.
There was an awful lot of hatred involved in that over
there. But to both of you, and to you in particular, Lisa, if it is a thing that the death penalty is imposed upon someone and we subsequently learn following their execution, God, they didn't do it, what do we do then?
Well, that's a totally different scenario, PJ.
But it's one that if you want to bring back the death penalty, you have to take it into consideration.
First, you'd have to be proven guilty, PJ, obviously, first.
But people have been, the Guildford Four were found guilty.
Oh, yeah, they were found
guilty. The Birmingham Six were found guilty.
But the death penalty wasn't imposed, PJ, that's what I'm saying.
Because it wasn't available.
Obviously, before it would be imposed, the person would have to be found guilty 100%.
But that's what juries do. That's what juries do.
On top of that, PJ, where is the deterrent? There's no deterrent. That's the crux of the problem here.
I agree with that there is no deterrent. I mean, the justice system here, let's be honest, it's a bit of a joke.
Like in your case, Sharon, and you've told me about that case before.
It's a big joke, being quite honest. PJ, I'm sorry to have to cut you off, but I have to go back to work.
That's okay, Lisa. I'll let you go. We'll continue with who we have. Thanks for your call. Appreciate it. 1850-715-996. Just focus on you for a second, Sharon. And you've told me about that case before and how it made you feel when that person walked free. But if the death penalty had been there, then you'd never have to face their face in the street again.
But I still wouldn't have agreed with it.
Yeah.
I don't believe that the state should be in the business of revenge.
At the end of the day,
that's murder too.
But what about saving people's lives? Children's lives that need a transplant? What about that, Lisa? What about that girl, you know?
Look, my opinion on this whole organ thing, okay? I believe it should be compulsory for everybody that when they die, your organs, if they can be used, should be used.
Well, we're getting there now, because it looks as if the government are fairly close to bringing in what they call an opt-out system, in that the card you'll carry will say you don't want to be a donor. Not that you want to be a donor. That's where we're going with that.
Well, I personally carry a donor card with me everywhere I go.
So do I. But let's start a text poll, guys, just at this juncture, and I'm going to do another break. So stay there, Sharon and Dan. We want to run a text poll. Penalty, yes. Penalty, no. If you think we should bring back the death penalty in certain circumstances, penalty, yes. If you think we shouldn't, penalty, no. 1850-715-996. Penalty, yes. Penalty, no. Text or WhatsApp 083-396-96-96. Stay there, Sharon and Dan and Frank, you're next.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world. Cork's 96 FM.
Text the Opinion Line now. This is what you came for. 083-396-96-96. Cork's 96 FM.
I'll bring you in next, Frank. But Dan, I just wanted, before I let you go, come up with a few messages on the harvesting thing. Someone said in a tweet and said, oh yeah, that's grand. So your sick uncle needs a heart, and here's the heart from the fellow who murdered your granny.
PJ, there's a lot of people in this country, people, for instance, like cystic fibrosis.
Yes.
And they'll probably die before they, you know, God love them, before they get any transplant. I mean, see, if a killer wants to repent and pay back to society, which I think he should do, I think he should automatically, if he's anywhere repentant at all, donate an organ. Let us see that, you know, that there's some compassion in him.
As a living donor?
Yes.
Okay. It's not a form of punishment I've heard of before, but Dan, thanks for bringing it to the mix. How about that one, Sharon, before I go to Frank?
No, I wouldn't agree with it, Peter. I really wouldn't. No, that's not saying that I'm heartless and I don't think people should get transplants, because I do believe people should get transplants. I believe everybody should, you know, when they die, it should be just automatic. I mean, let's face it, you're not going to need them where you're going, lads.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They can take what they can from me. It's probably not going to be much, but whatever they can take, they can have.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it should be compulsory.
Okay. Leave that one with you, Sharon, if you're okay with that. Thank you very much. 1850-715-996. Thanks for holding, Frank. Bringing up the Guildford 4 case again.
Well, yeah, the judge in that case actually stated that if it was available to him, he would have imposed the death penalty.
Yeah. Now, Trish corrected that on Twitter when I read it out, and Trish, who lives in London, she said, actually what the judge said was, I don't know why they weren't charged with treason.
For which
the death penalty still applies.
Yeah, no, I think the reason they weren't charged with treason is because they were Irish citizens, as far as I can remember.
Yeah.
But if one person is killed in the wrong, then that's one too many, and it's not worth taking the chance. You'll always have bad convictions, PJ.
Yes.
No, I heard the girl there saying like that the sentences aren't long enough, and she was mentioning a 7-year. That obviously wasn't a murder conviction.
Yeah.
And probably a manslaughter or something, maybe. But I mean,
well, in Sharon's case, it was a relative of hers, and the person, the killer, pleaded to manslaughter, got 7 years, and got a reduction in the sentence because of pleading guilty, and they were out in 22 months. I mean,
well, it's crazy. I agree, it's absolutely crazy. But as you said, all the judge can do is follow what's in front of him. I mean, we had the famous case in Cork, not mentioning any names, where the judge said he knew he couldn't please everybody, but he was following the law.
Yeah, there's a guy from Dublin, you might have heard the interviews with him in the last couple of days, who's now confessed to being involved in the Birmingham bombings. I mean, there were innocent people served time in jail for that too.
There was, and there was also 21 killed. And I was listening to another show yesterday where a prominent barrister came on and said that chap probably couldn't be tried, because he just stayed slightly on the right side of admitting nothing.
Oh, he knew exactly what he was saying, and he'd been extremely well coached. I watched the interview.
I watched the interview afterwards. No, about this thing about harvesting organs.
Yes.
I think that's going down the joke line. I mean, sure, at the end of the day, why not just chop off the legs and feed the bones to the dogs?
Well, where you're heading there, Frank, and it only occurred to me when you're heading down the road of Sharia law there.
Oh, you are, absolutely.
You steal an apple, you lose your hand.
I mean, yeah, and what happens if you win the appeal? Do they stitch it back on?
Good point.
But I mean, I think it's been proven statistically at this stage in America.
Yes.
It's absolutely no deterrent.
Yes. Kevin was making that point yesterday on Twitter, that the murder rate doesn't drop anyway significantly.
No, none whatsoever. You know, I don't think people who commit murder ever think of the consequences.
Yeah.
And I do believe, I mean, people were saying the sentencing is crazy. I believe most recent statistics is that anybody in Ireland who did get life, it's between 15 and 18 years.
Yes.
You know, it's not what people are saying about the 7, the 8, the 9 years. Is it long enough?
The last people who were sentenced to the death penalty in this country were, I believe, a couple who murdered a Garda, whose name I can't recall. It'll come to me back in
that
the...
That was in Waterford, I believe, yeah.
Yes, and they were commuted to 40
Reynolds,
years.
Reynolds, I think.
Guard Reynolds, good man, Frank.
Yeah.
Guard Reynolds. There was a couple convicted of that. They were commuted to 40 years.
40 years.
Yeah.
There was quite a few of them.
1985.
No, I don't know how long... they spent in jail, but I believe that chap who was caught in the Attorney General's apartment in that goo-boo thing,
yeah.
I mean, he's only been released recently. I'd say he must have done about 30.
He did. The last person hanged in Ireland was a fellow called Michael Manning. Right, Frank, listen, thanks for that. You can't bring it back because you'll get it wrong. you'll get it wrong just once, and to get it wrong just once is once too often. Last person, last hanging, last execution in this country was Michael Manning in 1954. William, how are you doing? You're on the air. Good morning.
Hello, PJ. I have some strange ideas as well. But I'd be totally against the death penalty as well as the state is concerned, because they get it wrong,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
On a different scale, maybe they should, if you take a look around the city at the moment, I know you have the junkies and all sorts running around the place. Maybe if they brought in, like what they did with the terrorists, inter them, put them in internment camps, cure them.
Yeah.
You know?
You see, if you go doing that, the one problem you'll have is these people are not criminals. They're ill.
They're potential criminals.
You can't jail somebody because they might do something.
Well, and you can inter them. It's been done.
It was, and look at the trouble that caused in the north.
But that's a totally different thing. You're actually making people better again. You know? That's a movement. That's an idea.
But any expert in addiction, and I've spoken to many of them, will tell you that until that person actually puts up their hand and says, "I want to be better," it'll never work. You can't force it on them.
No, but if you take away the sickness, the cause of the sickness, yeah, and show them a better way.
So you'd be all for interning people who are on the streets through addiction?
Inter them and get them better. Put them to work. Get them off the drugs and put them to work properly and give them some bit of life. Because what they have at the moment is just death looking forward to.
And why would you be so opposed to the death penalty?
Because they get it wrong.
And what about Dan's idea of harvesting an organ or two?
Jesus, that's like a Hammer House of Horror situation. That's vampirism, you know.
Thanks, William. 1850 715996. Just some of your comments. Hold on there, Diarmaid, you're in next. Hi, PJ, listening to the show all the time. The gentleman who said just now that if you're proven without a shadow of a doubt that it was proven you took another life, you should have the death penalty upon you. These people are like a cancer in society and should be caught out and dispatched. Penalty, yes. Why not? If they killed your mam, what would you say? That's our text poll, by the way. If you'd like the death penalty, or you think the death penalty should return, penalty, yes. If you think it shouldn't, penalty, no. Tom has given out to me. He says it's a useless subject because it's never going to happen. I know, Tom, but we could talk about a lot of things that'll never happen too. Do you know, it's not all about reality every day. Nice cup of tea now to you, Ed. Thomas says 7 years with 3 suspended and released after 21 months for murder. That was a joke. That was in Sharon's case. A relation of hers was killed. It was manslaughter. The man pleaded to manslaughter. But yeah, for someone's death, 21 months. Catherine points out that they have a lot of executions in China. I was reading a statistic, actually. There's some of the highest rates of execution in the world in China. Liam says, bring back public flogging and public executions. It's the only language that men understand. PJ says, could you ask Dan, or Tom says, could you ask Dan if he puts the body parts of ordinary people, will the DNA mix and turn them all into murderers? I have no idea. Right, Diarmaid, bringing you in here. You're not impressed with what you're hearing this morning. Good morning.
No, have the lunatics taken over the asylum? Poor Lisa, God bless her. It's a pity you couldn't have got a better proponent of the death penalty. You know, a woman who didn't know very much about the Guildford Four. You know what? I don't think she ever heard of the Guildford Four. The poor thing. Three overwhelming. By the way, it was Gordon Michael Reynolds who was shot dead by the Murrays.
That's right. Thank you for that.
In Dublin. Right. There aren't many Gordy murder, thanks but to God Almighty. But that a name like that shouldn't just trot off your tongue and know the area. They served about. They were given 40 years. Well,
they're
commuted.
Are they out now?
And I think they were released. There was some exceptions made in their case or whatever. But you should read about the Murrays, actually. Two loons, if ever you came across. They belong to some political. Their own political party, effectively. And they effectively didn't believe in society, and they didn't believe in this, and they didn't believe in that, and whatever. And they went out to carry out robbery, bank robbery. And Garda Michael Reynolds, God bless the man, he intercepted their car on the way, and he was shot at virtual point blank range.
That's right.
In Raheny in Dublin.
That's anyway, right. And they got the death penalty, and it was commuted.
The death penalty was commuted to 40 years. But you see, as they were unaligned, they weren't in the IRA, they weren't in the INLA, they weren't in where most of the guys, whoever carried out the murders, they served them guys. You know, whatever, they served upwards on 30 years of the 40-year sentence. But anyway. I'm absolutely and totally against the death penalty for three extremely good reasons.
Mm.
First one, it's a human system. Too many mistakes are made. The second one, and I think it's the most important one, which is it's not much of a punishment.
Excuse me?
It's too quick for them. It's too quick for them. Much better that they languish in prison and they watch their elderly parents grow more feeble by the day. They watch their brother get married. They can't attend the wedding. They watch their brother's wife or whatever, you know, having a child. Never seen that child. Can't bring it to the maximum security prison. You know, that's a much, much, much better punishment. And thirdly, it takes too long. And all the attention is focused on the offender.
Mm.
Have you ever been in America when somebody was about to be executed? Have you ever been on holiday there?
No, other than following it on CNN or anyone.
You should go there. It would just blow your mind because tonight at 6, you know, tonight at 10 p.m. Joe Smith or Johnny Bungu or whatever.
Oh, I followed that stuff. Yeah.
No. This is fact. On the hour, he's got 9 hours left to live. He's got 8 hours left to live, and they hardly mention the victims.
Yeah.
They might say in passing, he was convicted in whatever, you know, 22 years ago of the murder of Jenny Smith or whoever, you know, and. And then the reason
it becomes a media circus is what you're saying.
It's a grotesque circus, and on top of that, it's a political circus. You've got the governor, the whole business in America. A governor is coming up for re-election. So what does he do? He just blows off the dust of the death penalty cases, and he just it's a grotesque circus. And the third reason, it's just it's monstrous. It's a monstrous. It's a cruel and unusual punishment. Too many mistakes are made, and then you've got the scenario of terrible mistakes being made.
What about Dan's idea? Harvest an old
lunacy.
Kidney.
Lunacy. as the man, he needs to take his tablets, because first of all, he's obviously never seen a program on TV about people donating organs, because there's a myriad of tests that have to be carried out, and only the best candidates are picked, as in the recipient.
Yeah, but I think his idea is, Dermot, look, if you're young and you're fit and you're healthy, then your kidney will suit somebody on the list. So just take it.
No, the way he was talking. Sorry, no. If you know, I'm repeating what he said. He says, if the man has lost a kidney, he gets it. He gets it. That's what he said. So the blood. So the offender could be blood type O, and the poor unfortunate victim is blood type A. So in his lunatic law. Blood type O.
No.
That's what he said. You have to take people by what they say.
I know where you're going with this, Jim, but I do. I know where you're going.
Anyway, it's never going to happen.
I'd like to hope, though, that he had a scientific idea behind it. You know what I mean? But still, lunacy is what you're thinking.
It's absolute lunacy. And also, people don't serve very long. You know, there was a grotesque picture on the front of one of the ghastly tabloids the other day, and it showed one of the fellas who murdered Mary Duffy up in Mayo. Evans, it's either Evans or Shaw's name. One has died. The other, I thought, had been released, but he hadn't. No, he's still in prison. That was 1976, 40 years ago. They're too dangerous. Sure, you become institutionalised. And it's Malcolm MacArthur who murdered Bridie Gargan.
Bridie Gargan,
in the Phoenix Park, and nearly brought the government down because he was
found in the Attorney General's house.
He was sleeping in Paddy Connolly's house. But anyway, what happened in that case was, like, he served the best part of he served.
But should life mean life, Diarmaid? Finally,
in many cases it does.
No, it doesn't.
It does. Look at it. Means life in Mary Duffy's case.
Life means the only way you come out of the prison is in a box. Is that life? Other than that, it's not life.
That's exactly what it means, because the parole board will never release you. By the way, when you hear these stories about the ghastly gangland people, those hideous creatures, they will die in prison.
If they're ever caught.
The parole board will never release you if there's the likelihood that you're going to suffer harm on the outside.
That's what we'd like to think, dear.
That's what happens.
I'm not so sure about that, dear.
It does happen.
I've taken call after call after call here over.
It was John Smith, and he served only 2 years of a life sentence. They all come up with this.
It was 9, 10 years, you know.
Pardon?
You could be out after 9, 10, 12.
You can apply for parole after 7 years, but just because
the average person, the average person sentenced to life in this country, dear mid-service, less than 20 years.
Yeah, but the thing is, in many cases, many of these people, they effectively give up because they've gone before the parole board. One of the things you learn.
Let's focus on that statistic for a second, right? The majority of people jailed for life in this country, and I think there were two of them handed down in the last 8 or 10 days. The majority of people jailed for life in this country statistically do less than 20 years, and a proportion of them do less than 15 years. Now, that's not life.
But they're released on license.
That's not life.
No, but do you not understand what
the release? Yeah, the release would have promised to behave themselves.
Yes, and if they do,
but the person they killed is still dead.
They're stuck straight back into prison. The parole board take the release of people very, very, very seriously.
So you're perfectly okay with someone being jailed for life today at the age of 23 or 24 and being back free on the streets before their 40th birthday? You're okay with that?
I can't say that it happens.
Ah, dear madam, of course it does.
Name a person for me then, PJ.
I couldn't pull a name off the top of my head, of course.
You couldn't remember the name, sorry.
But anecdotally, it happens. Don't tell me it doesn't, because people will ring. Look at the case of the guy who killed Sharon's relative. Now, it was manslaughter. He did plead to manslaughter. But he was on the streets again after 21 months. That's not justice.
He was never convicted of murder.
He pleaded to manslaughter.
They accepted manslaughter wrongly, in my view.
Well, maybe.
Because I know that case, actually.
Yeah.
But whatever. Often the prosecution is just.
But
lazy.
You're suggesting that it's okay for someone to be released after between 15 and 20 years of what we believe to be a life sentence. That's okay.
In some circumstances, it is. Because maybe the person is. Let's pretend the person is 60 years of age. But in many cases, these people die in prison. There's no other people who die in prison because, you see, they become worn down by the system. And God, and in many cases, good riddance to them.
Take the case of Eamon Lillis, who killed Celine Cawley, and he was out in 5 years and 1 month and collected all her money.
There should be a law. There should be a law to prevent somebody from inheriting money from somebody you've killed. That's not the fault of the prison system.
Yeah.
But trying to cop.
Doesn't it just illustrate how much the law needs to be changed? Diarmaid, I'm running short on time, but thanks as always. Great to talk to you. I could stay with Diarmaid for the morning. 1850 715 996. Tricia said, I'm going to say this, I agree with Diarmaid. Ian Brady and Myra Hindley suffered every day till they died. They literally rotted in prison. But that's just the point, Tricia. It doesn't happen here. I'm against the death penalty, as it's not my right to take anyone's life, but a life sentence should be that. Life. says Maureen in Clon. And the facts, the statistics are there. The majority of people jailed for life in this country are out in between 15 and 20 years. Someone who kills somebody at the age of 20 will more than likely be back on the streets again by their 40th birthday. Is that ever right? Let's keep that text poll going until the 10 o'clock news. Penalty, yes, if you think the death penalty should come back. Penalty, no, if you think it shouldn't. 083 396 96 96.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world. Cork's 96 FM. We'll be
coming down. Vote for your favourite song on tonight's Top 10 at 10. We'll be counting down. Go to 96fm.ie right now. Call the Opinion Line.
This is what you came for.
1850-715-996. Cork's 96FM.
I'm going to change tack for a minute because we got an email in. And it's interesting that we get the email today of all days, the 12th of July, which, as you know, is such a controversial day in the north of Ireland. In fact, it's such a controversial day that a European Champions League qualifier match between Glasgow Celtic and Linfield has been postponed until Friday. It's been rescheduled for 5 o'clock kickoff Friday at Windsor Park in Belfast. That is between Linfield and Glasgow Celtic in the Champions League qualifier. Normally, the matches would be played yesterday or today or that sort of thing, or tomorrow. But because of the 12th of July and all the controversy, bonfires, marches, etc., etc., then they've put them off until Friday. Anyway, in the midst of all of that, we got an email from someone who signed themselves as Hawkeye, but we do have their real name. We just won't be using it. They've asked us not to because they're at work. This is Hawkeye's email to do with that match.
Hi, PJ. If a team representing Ireland faced a team representing Scotland in a sporting contest, football, rugby, table tennis, hockey, judo, badminton, it doesn't matter. You'd expect Irish people to rally behind the boys and girls in green, wouldn't you? The upcoming UEFA qualifier between Linfield FC and Glasgow Celtic presents a unique situation in which Irish football fans will be supporting a team from a country in the United Kingdom, ahead of a team from Ireland, and justifying their support by means of a spectacular feat of hypocrisy and self-deception. They are none so blind as those who will not see. To put it in simple terms, Irish nationalists' core claim is that Ireland should be a 32-county republic. Linfield FC was founded in Belfast in 1886 and is based in Windsor Park, Belfast. Therefore, by their own definition, Linfield FC is an Irish club. Celtic FC was founded in Glasgow in 1887 and is based in Parkhead Stadium, Glasgow. Last time I checked, Glasgow is in Scotland. Scotland voted in a referendum to remain in the United Kingdom. Therefore, Celtic FC is a British club. So please explain to me again why Irish nationalist football fans are supporting a foreign team this week. The ludicrous argument some of them will make is that Celtic is an Irish club, but as I've clearly demonstrated above, it is not. They'll claim Celtic is a Catholic club. I can't see how that makes the slightest difference. When, for example, was the last time any of those shouting the loudest have been to Mass? And how many of the current Celtic players are Catholic? They're professional athletes contracted to play football for Celtic FC. They could just as easily be contracted to play for any club of similar standing. It's simply not relevant. So let's all get behind Linfield FC. Sincerely, Hawkeye.
That's an interesting one. Hawkeye's belief is if you're an Irish nationalist, then politically you believe in a 32-county Ireland. Linfield are a team from 32-county Ireland. Therefore, Hawkeye's argument is that Linfield are an Irish club. Hawkeye's argument is that because Celtic are from Scotland, then they are a British club. Celtic, of course, were founded by an Irishman, I believe a priest from County Sligo, back in, he gave the year. But Celtic are a British club, and Hawkeye's argument is that Linfield are an Irish club, and that religion should have nothing to do with it. And we said we'd get Richard, thanks to Richard for that, to read that email, and just put it out there, We put it up on Facebook last night. There was a mighty reaction to it on Facebook. A lot of people not very impressed with Hawkeye. But it's out there now. Let's see what you think. The match is Friday night. If you have any thoughts on that, 1850 715 996 or text us to 083 396 9696.
You're listening to a repeat of the 96FM Opinion Line. Phone and text lines are now closed. The Opinion Line with PJ Coogan. 1850-715-996.
Reminder again what we're asking about, that table from Argos. If you have one, the glass top table called the Sicily. Keep an eye out the back garden for that later on. They'll tell you why afterwards. Also, listening to that in the news with Barry about Dennis Nocton trying to knock back this idea the Green Party have about the non-disposable coffee cups. He wants to ban the non-disposable or non-recyclable coffee cup, and Dennis Nocton's trying to knock it back. It reminds me of an idea that they've had now in the Balearic Islands. I'll be paying it myself when I'm there over the next couple of weeks. It's called an eco tax. Everybody has to pay it. Now, it's only about a euro or 50 cents a day or whatever, but you gotta pay it. And what it's for is so that they can sustain the environmental damage. They can recover the environmental damage caused by tourism every year in the Balearic Islands. Fascinating idea. They'll collect maybe 10, 15, 20 quid from everybody that goes there on holidays over the course of the season. And they'll then use that money to improve their recycling, improve their disposal, and improve all that kind of thing, which is a super idea. 1850, people are moaning about it, but anyway, 1850 715 996. Text us to 083 396 9696. The email opinion at 96fm.ie. During the week, it came out again that we have huge trolley watch figures, and we're going to talk about emergency departments for a while, but not in terms of numbers on trolleys. Because Dr. Chris Luke, who we've spoken to on the show many times, has written an article on the website healthmanager.ie about, now this has got a fairly highfalutin title, but I've no doubt that Chris will explain it very simply. It's called The Vital Role of Emotional Intelligence in Healthcare. And Chris's argument is that if you have emotional intelligence, if professionals, healthcare professionals working in an emergency department employ their emotional intelligence, it won't necessarily solve the overcrowding problem, but it'll make it an awful lot easier to wait to be seen, to be treated. It'll make the hardship that people go through in an emergency department much easier. And we want to talk to him about that. Morning, Chris.
Morning, PJ.
Am I summing that up properly?
Well, you are, but don't forget that I wrote that article, which is aimed at health managers, hospital managers, civil servants, and politicians. I mean, they're the ones that I've suggested need to deploy a bit more emotional intelligence, which is basically reading the emotional vibrations, trying to understand what people are feeling, and in other words, what motivates them. And that applies to both staff and patients because I think it's very, very important that we realise that in the overcrowded emergency departments of our country and, many English-speaking countries around the world, it's not just patients now who are very distressed, it's also the staff. And, we hear year after year about the increasing difficulty in staffing our emergency departments. And that is, I think, primarily because it's so difficult now to work in the emergency department. It's so upsetting. I mean, often staff are as distressed and upset as the patients. And, they're all upset for the same reason. It's overcrowded. It's difficult to be seen. There are delays and so forth. And yet, the fundamental requirements of healthcare are, the reassuring smile, the handshake, the warm welcome, the reassurance, the glass of water and the chair. Those are the fundamentals of kindly healthcare, because ultimately what human beings need of others is kindness. And I would argue that the greatest difficulty we face in our emergency departments is the provision of kindness, because it's so difficult, the conditions are so difficult.
Yeah. You know you're going to be there for a long time. Are you suggesting that if there was more attention paid to that simple human kindness, that long wait might be easier?
Well, I'm suggesting that kindness is directed towards both patients and staff. And I'm talking really from above. And I'm talking about the need to decongest the departments to enable patients and staff to have a better experience. Because by definition, if you're working in conditions that resemble a refugee camp, it's very difficult for warmth to be extended, you know, in either direction. It's very difficult for kindness to be shown. It's very difficult for people to sit down, you know, to achieve privacy and so on. And then onto the many technical problems we have in terms of delayed treatment and disposal and so forth. So I'm trying to get people to think about what we're trying to do in hospitals, which is ultimately to, you know, to be kindly and caring towards the needy in our society.
Mm. Now, you mostly work at the Mercy, but you worked across the CUH as well.
And true. I work in both.
You work in both. Departments. And any one of those, with all due respect to anyone who works out there at any time on a Saturday night, can look like something out of the bad days of Beirut.
Well, I mean,
and you dread going in there.
Don't restrict it to Saturday nights. I mean, I don't want to upset anybody, but you know, 24/7 in both departments, it can be, as you suggest, it can be extraordinarily crowded and difficult for everybody concerned. So, you know, the idea that it's something to do with winter or Saturday, you know, we really move beyond that. I mean,
and people get forgotten.
No. It's not a question. No, I mean, well, the conditions are so difficult. I mean, the crowding, you know, it's like sometimes like being in Semple Stadium and trying to provide, you know, high tech care. You know what I mean? On a busy, you know, Munster semi final, trying to provide high quality care in the crowd.
Yeah.
So overcrowding of itself. Is one of the difficulties, and I keep trying to convey to the powers that be, the people who are in charge of the health service, the people who have the resources to, or the control over the resources to enable us to provide the kindness, which is what people need and what professionals want to give.
Mm. A few months ago, I was talking on the show about something that used to annoy me consistently when I was following ministers around as part of my day job. Was any time a health minister would come to town and they'd be brought to the hospital, sure, you'd get is the smell of new paint, and the place always looked like there was never a problem. Ministers were brought into this carefully staged pantomime, and they stood there with hospital management, everybody smiling at one another. Nobody ever mentioned the kind of conditions that you're talking about.
Well, PJ, can I just say to you that I'm very glad you raised that, because I have photographs of that happening.
Yes.
For my memoirs, which will be published in due course, obviously. But, you know, that kind of crystallizes what I mean. I mean, I don't know if it crosses the minds of those who engage in that kind of carry-on, how upsetting that is for the staff. The staff who are heroically enduring these conditions day in, day out for months or years, and then suddenly with the switch of a button or the signature of a missive from the head office, this sort of stuff happens. People are, you know, shifted and hidden in wards and corridors for the duration of the visit, and then normal service resumes. I don't know if people understand just how incredibly upsetting that is for the staff.
But what infuriates people too is that the ministers, and if you take in particular, Chris, Leo Varadkar, James Riley, both practicing doctors in their time, they stood in front of that and they knew and they nodded their head.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to get specific here, PJ, but they're all at it. That's all I can say to you. They're all. I'm 35 years at this game, PJ, and I've seen all colours engage in this sort of carry on.
Oh, yeah.
And as I say, that in fact is the great example of how that's a kind of a display of contempt for the staff, and it's in fact, I think that's one of the reasons at the very top of the list of reasons why staff leave. When they see that being under, you know, that kind of carry on, they say, you don't have to be, you know, a psychologist to see what that implies in terms of the regard for the staff and the patients.
So come back down to the article, management, and obviously they're political masters because the public healthcare system is politically run. What must, in order to make the job on the ground in the ED easier to do and to make the ED an easier place to go, what should they do? Is it about money?
We need space, you know, so we need bigger departments, we need parts of the hospital to accommodate other patients. We need to divert patients from the emergency department who would be better off elsewhere. I mean, patients who are not emergencies, I mean, just to go back to the basic idea that ultimately, you know, originally emergency departments were designed to cater for emergencies, which in a sense were things that occurred unexpectedly, unpredictably, and needed immediate care. Now the departments are full of people who have long-standing issues where there's been perhaps a tipping point, people who have long-standing issues where they pop in for a second opinion, or they're trying desperately to get, you know, onto the waiting. And again, all of this is entirely understandable. People behave rationally from their own point of view because the waiting lists for example, orthopaedics, you name the specialty, the waiting lists are very, very lengthy. So people do end up coming to the emergency department because the resources are not available for the other parts of the community health service and so forth. So, you know, it comes down to resources, but it also comes down to leadership. You know, we need the leaders to say and to show by actions that they care about how people feel within the departments of our hospitals, because people's feelings matter, because, you know, feelings range from fear and anxiety when you arrive to sometimes rage, fury, angry when you wait for, you know, for what seems like an age, or when you leave and you're not happy. So, you know, feelings really, really matter, and they have to be incorporated into managers' calculations, but very often they don't seem to be.
No. And the you write in your piece about is there a lack of understanding in management about the stress of both being a patient and the stress of trying to treat people in the atmosphere that's there? Is there an unwillingness or a lack of care upstairs?
Well, you would say to yourself, is it possible that someone in charge of the health service, the health care service, doesn't understand that caring is the gig? You know, footballers play football and tennis players play tennis. Healthcare professionals are there to care expertly and enthusiastically and professionally. And if you will prevent them from doing that, from caring, then you have to say, well, what is the service there for otherwise? Is it just there as a warehouse? So, I only hope that for political reasons, the powers that be kind of suppress the understanding they have that it must be very difficult for people within the emergency departments and somehow get on with other political, imperatives. But I think those at the very, very top need to demonstrate urgently that they really, really care about everybody within the emergency departments. I'm talking about the reception staff, I'm talking about security, I'm talking about patients, I'm talking about all the healthcare professionals and so forth, because sometimes we feel as if we are truly forgotten and the purpose of our existence is truly forgotten.
Mm. And, of course, the exodus of staff.
Well, I mean, it's frightening, PJ. You know, we have 700 graduates a year from our medical schools, where more than half leave the system because they can't bear the prospects. And it's incredibly difficult to get staff to work in the emergency departments, nursing or medical or other staff, because they know what it's like at the pointy end of the hospital. So, you know, I would say if there was only one reason for politicians and the powers that be to change their tactics, I would say, if just to avoid this constant expenditure on locums and, you know, scratching around for people to fill in gaps, if only for that reason, if they could improve the conditions for the existing staff and patients, they might make a good start on improving recruitment.
Something that the nursing unions consistently bring up, and I've spoken about this with Liam Doran many times, that the amount of money spent on agency staff, in particular agency nursing staff, that money should be redirected to actually permanently, properly employed staff. Would that be the same on the doctor's side of things?
Yeah, hundreds of millions of euro are spent on providing locums because we don't have enough doctors. I mean, I don't want to get into the specifics, but we have something like 10 to 20% of the staff we need in terms of, you know, of the medical provision compared with the UK or Australia. I mean, most big departments in the UK now have 10 consultants in emergency medicine and upwards. The really big ones that would be the size of CUH or St. James's in Ireland, they'd have 20. And we have 4 or 5 consultants, for example, in Cork, covering the whole county and all the hospitals therein. So that gives you some sense of where we are. And the same applies to the doctors and training numbers. You know, we probably have 20 to 30% of the comparable figures across the water and in Australia. So again, you know, I would say, look, please think about how hard it is for those who are trying to provide expert and excellent care, and concentrate on improving the numbers rather than following political dogma. And you will see, because I tell you something, PJ, the people who are within the emergency departments are extraordinarily heroic and wonderful people. And with just a little bit of support, you'd be amazed what they can do.
All right. Listen, Chris, good to talk to you. That article makes for very interesting reading. Thank you. Dr. Chris Luke, 1850-715-996. I always wanted, ever since that came up, I wanted to bring that up with Chris about the pantomime that's put on whenever a minister turns up at a hospital department. This ridiculously stupid pantomime that turns up where the minister is there and all the hospital suits are there and it's all spick and span and you can smell the clean and you can smell the fresh paint and there isn't a trolley on site and nobody is in any kind of distress. And that is put on as a pantomime for the minister. And there's Chris Luke reflecting how bloody infuriating that is for the staff and everybody involved. 1850-715-996. Deirdre was impressed by what Chris Luke had to say, and I'll talk to her next time.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world. Cork's 96 FM.
Text the Opinion Line now. This is what you came for. 083-396-96-96. Cork's 96 FM.
Now, Deirdre, you're listening to Dr. Luke.
Good morning, Peter.
Makes a huge amount of sense, doesn't it? If upstairs doesn't care, then downstairs can't operate.
Absolutely. I'm not shocked that it's Dr. Chris Luke wrote the article, because I've been listening to him over the years. And he's been quite vocal in how he runs his business, and he runs his business with empathy and with emotional intelligence, and you can see that in him. He's a very, very decent man. Now, what I am, I suppose, shocked at really is that I'm shocked that I am so impressed, because you would expect that it would be a standard that any medical professional or anybody anywhere, and it doesn't need to be a medical professional, would stand over. But we expect more from the medical professional. We expect more from the community that gives us our healthcare. Mm. And we don't see it on the ground. We often don't see it on the ground simply because I think myself that, how many times have we heard the story that when we were in hospital that someone said that they got more attention from the person that brought them the cup of tea?
Mm-hmm.
That the birthday card was bought by the person. There were long-term stay. The birthday card was bought by the person that made the cup of tea. And I think what happens here, PJ, is that as people go up the ranks, they often very much forget to be nice.
Right.
I think that they become so busy and they become so serious in themselves, they often forget to be nice. Mm. And if each of us were to just stay in our own space, and if we were to remember that what life is about and what healthcare is about remembering how a person's day may have been before they ever arrived in the hospital. Chris said that it's when people are arriving at the hospital, they very often, in his article, he said they very often know that they've made choices that have been bad for them. They're already feeling bad about that. And then they come up against a brick wall, or they come up against services that aren't as good as they should be. A lot of that is business. A lot of that is the person not focused on good healthcare, which includes empathy, which includes emotional intelligence, whatever. But if we're not seeing it from the powers that be, if we're not seeing it from the Chris Lukes of this world, if we're not seeing people come out and talk like this, and we know we've heard the stories about the minister arrives at the hospital, and I'm just finished a science master's in Royal College of Surgery on ethics and on how to be ethical, including in medical law. And a lot of the nurses that I would talk to over the years, they would say that there is nothing more frustrating for them than to find the whole place cleared because a minister has decided to bring the press.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, evidence sprouts up, and many of the nurses will say, we don't have time for this today. And I've heard consultants say, we don't have time for this today.
Yeah, but still it gets done.
I mean, for the minister, for a minister or for somebody who is allocating services, allocating funding, to not know that these people, and I see it a lot with meds, that they genuinely want to get on with their job. But if the powers that be and if the people like the Chrysalics of this world don't speak up and don't say what they expect of their staff and the pressures that they're under, how can we change things?
Chris wouldn't specifically focus on any minister at all because he said they all do it. But the two that strike me is our now Taoiseach, Mr. Varadkar, and the previous health minister, Dr. James Riley, both of whom are qualified doctors, both of whom stood in front of that pantomime, as I call it, knew or should have known that it was all there. Both of those were a disgrace to the office.
Appalling. And specifically because they trained as meds. And we're expected that if we train as meds that we're going to have some sort of extra feeling. And it's not there. And these men, and I mean, maybe the likes of Chris, maybe it's difficult for Chris and for people in charge of emergency services to be pointing at people who didn't do their jobs properly. But I can, because I can see the sort of flippant, and I do put it down to gaps in people's development that they just can't stand for 2 minutes and be appropriate. Now, the person on the street who doesn't know where they're sleeping tonight, I can understand why they can't concentrate because they're not going anywhere tonight. But the likes of Leo, the likes of James Riley, they know where they're sleeping tonight. They're on bloody good pay. Finances can be a big problem for people, and you can start to concentrate when finances are bad. But they know exactly where they're sleeping tonight. They know exactly what shirt they're putting on in the morning. They have people to take care of them. And they still act in an extremely flippant way about how they go about their business. Can they not just wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning and say to themselves, right, I have a day ahead of me now, and I'm going to be dealing with people on the ground who are in a dreadful state, who are going through accidents and emergency with their damaged toenail, simply because if they ring the doctor and try to get in another way, they've learned to go through accidents and emergency like that, because that's the only way they're going to be hurt, and they have no voice. And if their voice is not the Leo Varadkars of this world, or their voice is not the James Riley of this world, who talk in a flippant way about people's feelings and not caring. And I do think that a lot of them not caring, PJ, is because they've forgotten to care. I mean, it's natural for us to care.
Or maybe it is that caring costs money, Deirdre.
But of course, and you have to, when you're allocating services and resources, you have to think about, I mean, palliative care is thinking all the time about people living longer and the resources. And you have to be practical. I mean, you know, we know recently about that couple and that baby in England, and they're hanging on to their baby. But they have to be practical. That decision would have been the same decision here. We have to be practical about resources. But if we have people like Chris Luke talking all the time about bringing emotions back to the service, watching how you deal with people, you will have a nicer community. You will have a better community. But you're not going to do it with one Chris Luke. You're going to need, and of course, in reality, we're voting these people in, and we have to look at who we're voting in, and we like shiny. I've said this to you before, PJ. We like shiny.
Yeah,
but shiny doesn't get an awful lot of work done, and we've seen that more than any time in the last few weeks. We've seen a lot of shiny. I don't like shiny. I just don't like shiny.
Because behind it, there's always something else. Deirdre, listen, thanks for your time. 1850-715-996. Appreciate that call. Joan has had a bad experience, one of many, and wants to talk about it. She went for a drink after work. And she got spiked. And her experience following being spiked has left her with a very sour taste in her mouth. I'll talk to Joan next. 1850-715-996.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world. Cork's 96 FM.
Call the Opinion Line. This is what you came for. 1850-715-996. Cork's 96 FM.
And I actually asked Joan to hold for me for a minute or two more because Suzanne was listening to me talking to Chris Luke and Deirdre. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, PJ. Good morning. We haven't spoken for a while. How
indeed,
are you?
Indeed. Particularly interested in what Chris Luke was saying.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking, you know, because Leo Varadkar is now Taoiseach, he obviously has a lot more power than even he had when he was Minister for Health going way back. But also, if his partner is a medic as well, they're young men. And I'm sorry, you know yourself, if you go home at night and if your wife is giving you bellyache and earache, pillow talk, giving out about her work environment or whatever, you're going to take note. And if you had any power where she's working, are you not going to use it? So my belief would be that unless he's made of stone and unless he doesn't give a shit, excuse my language, about his partner's work environment and how it's being run, surely if his partner is coming home saying, geez, the management is really bad and all the bureaucracy and the pen pushing and we need more medics and we need more whatever, he's a medic himself who has stepped out of it. So he's going to take notice of what his partner says. You're also going to be sure that an awful lot of their friends are going to be young medics as well, who are going through the lower ranks in their training. If not, like some of them would be just consultants, I suppose, at 38, 40 years of age. But it must get through to him. And if we don't see action within the health service now for stopping bureaucracy in the next 6 to 9 months, where Leo isn't picking up the phone and saying to the Minister for Health or whoever, come here, whatever is going on in Vincent or James's or the CUH or wherever, deal with it.
But Suzanne, you see, Leo in his time and James Riley before him and Mary Harney before him and Micheál Martin before her and as Simon Harris, I believe, is doing it as well, they turn up for this special day at the hospital where there's fresh flowers, fresh paint, shiny, and they know it's a pantomime and they keep their mouths shut.
Yeah, but listen, if your wife, PJ, if his partner is working in the real environment and he's coming home saying, I can't believe you stood by that crap today. I'm sorry. Do you think your relationship would survive that?
I don't know. I don't think so, to be perfectly honest with you, Suzanne.
So I just think that, I would like to think that we will see changes in the next 6 to 9 months. I think this is, if ever there was an opportunity, this is it, okay. Really. Because politics is a dirty, dirty game. Yeah. And I know personal relationships shouldn't affect it, but if you're human, they're going to.
We'll watch it with interest, Suzanne. Good to talk to you again. Thank you. 1850-715-996. Suzanne's one of our regulars. It's been a while. Eugene says, when I was in hospital 2 years ago, I actually went a full nursing shift without being seen by a nurse. The nurse came in at 8:30 in the morning. I didn't see her again until 4 or 5 in the evening. I was in a single room. It was due to understaffing. She couldn't make it around with all the other patients. On the other hand, I had an amazing night nurse. It was like having my own private nurse. And Tom says, you should do a program on politicians and ban them from the show and let them listen to the public and to heroes like Chris Luke and to many others. And by WhatsApp, could you say one thing that would really help the patients on trolleys is to let them know they're not being forgotten. I know they probably aren't, but the patient needs the reassurance. My daughter's been on trolley in the Mersey since 7 o'clock yesterday. You see, and when that happens, you feel forgotten. Now, Joan, thanks for holding you there for a while. Good morning.
Hi, it's okay.
You had a most unpleasant experience when you went for a couple of drinks after work. When was that?
That was last Friday evening. I went for a couple of drinks with all my work colleagues.
Yeah.
And I was on my third pint, and I was having a lovely evening, have a chat the way. Most of the people I was there with were a little bit older than me, so in their 30s and 40s. And
right.
It was all civilised.
You're in your 20s, I think, are you?
I'm 23, yeah.
Okay.
So So anyways, I finished my third pint, put it down, and suddenly I just felt violently ill. I ran to the bathroom, got projectile sick everywhere.
Oh, God.
And I just laid on the floor then, and I must have fallen asleep, and I was in like a comatose state. One of my female colleagues came in to check on me because I hadn't been back to the table, and I was completely fine when I went. So she came in to check on me, and she found me like that. And
you passed out, you were?
Yeah, I was lying on the floor, and I knew what was going on. I just couldn't move.
Oh, goodness.
So she brought me out of the pub that we were in and took me home, which was only, we'll say, a five-minute walk away. So she took me straight home, and when I got home, my two housemates saw me, and, like, I'm not a heavy drinker. I've never taken hard drugs in my life, so they knew that something was wrong with me. So I got sick everywhere again, and then they said, Rosie, you're not right. Like, you're swaying around the place, and, you know, you look very, very, very ill. I was also, like, dribbling and stuff, they said, you need to go to A&E. And usually I put up a big fight about that because I don't like a fuss, and I hate being in hospital. So, but I was just in this state. I was so compliant with anyone. I would have gone anywhere with anyone and done anything. So they brought me to A&E, and that was all okay. I got into A&E, and I gave my name, my address, whether I had a medical card or not. I gave all of this to the receptionist.
Mm. You were coherent enough, weren't you?
I was coherent enough. I just, my body wasn't, I couldn't control. Like, they were helping me to walk. They were helping me to sit.
Right.
I wasn't drunk. And I know that I got spiked because I've never felt like that before in my life.
Yes.
And I was only drinking, you know, beer. I wasn't drinking any spirit.
And this came on you literally else. Within seconds, John.
Literally. Yeah, I had to actually run to the bathroom.
My God.
Yeah. Yeah, so I got into A&E then, and I gave her all of my details and that, and I sat with my two housemates who were completely sober. And as I was sitting there waiting to be admitted, I felt sick again. So I told my housemates, I feel like I'm going to be sick. Can you get one of those little sick buckets that they have?
Yeah.
So he went up anyway, and he asked the receptionist, look, she's feeling really ill again. She's in a bad way. She's going to be sick. Can I have a sick bucket? And she just shoved my invoice into his hand and carried on typing.
Invoice?
My invoice for being in A&E.
Good God.
You know, it's €100 to get seen, which is fair enough, I suppose. Like, you have to pay for your medical care. That's kind of fine. But she gave him my invoice, and he was like, okay, but, like, she needs a bucket. Like, she's going to be sick. And then, you know, she turned around to get a bucket or something, but she was being so deliberately slow. I don't know why. I think she hoped I was going to run out of the waiting room and get sick outside, but I couldn't
About
move.
What time of the evening was this, John?
This was 9:45.
Okay, so it wasn't exactly the middle of the night.
It was 9:45 in the evening, like 9:45 p.m.
Okay.
Yeah. So I got sick on the floor while I was waiting for this bucket.
God.
And I just felt so embarrassed because there was families and stuff around me. And I just felt like, I was a cleaner for 5 years. I know how awful cleaning up sick is. And it was so avoidable. And it really made me feel embarrassed of myself.
Yes. And was the place crowded?
Like, I at this stage, I had my invoice, but I had no sick bucket.
Good God.
So then I got admitted into the actual A&E bit, you know, behind the double doors.
Yes.
And I sat on a bed, or a trolley, I don't know which it was. And I said, you know, can I lie down? I feel really disorientated and everything. Can I lie down? And the nurse said, no, we need that for other patients. Stay sitting up. So I was like, okay. And I leaned on my housemate, who was also sitting on the bed. Like, he was very good. He looked after me all evening. So I was leaning against him, kind of dozing in and out of being asleep and being just not right at all. Mm. And then another nurse came along and she said, oh, Pet, why are you sitting up? Lay down there, get under the blanket. And my housemate was like, oh, you know, that nurse over there has just said that we can't lie on this bed, like that she needs it for another patient. And she was like, oh no, this bed is yours, don't mind her, lay down, like here's a pillow. And she was so kind and so nice, but she wasn't my nurse, so she hadn't a clue what was going on, and she couldn't tell me, you know, that it was going to be okay.
But that, that little gesture.
Yeah, she was like, oh, lie down. And as soon as I lied down, I just felt a million times better, because it was so hard to even just stay sitting up. So then my actual nurse came back over and pricked my finger for my blood sugar and took my, you know, the one where they wrap it really tight around your arm. Is that your blood pressure?
Blood pressure, yeah. The cough, and they inflate the cough.
And my housemate had told her exactly what had happened. You know, I'd had 3 pints and then I was violently ill, laying on the floor, couldn't walk, blah, blah. And she didn't even acknowledge him or that he had told her any of this. She didn't say a word to me. I suppose they see people in bad way all the time, but she should have at least said to him, thank you for that. I'm going to look after you. You could be here for a while, but, you know, you're here now. You're fine. She didn't even answer him.
Mm-hmm.
She left the cuff around my arm and walked off. And that was the last time I saw her. My housemate had to take the cuff off of me, and he put it onto her little silver trolley that they have beside the bed. So he took all that off and I laid back down on the bed. And then after about 3 hours of that, like still no nothing from anybody, she didn't come back and say your blood sugars are okay or anything. She didn't say anything. She didn't even speak to me. So I went back up then. I felt a small bit better.
Yeah.
I felt like I could kind of control myself again, and I felt I walked from the bed up to the reception, which was more than I'd been able to do all night. And I said to the nurse, my name is X, and this is what's been going on, and can I go home because I feel a small bit better? And she said that we wouldn't be doing anything for you anyway.
Okay.
And that was it. That was my whole experience.
And did you find out what you'd actually been given?
No. They don't test you for anything. They don't do anything. They just judge you that you're drunk and leave you there, basically. That was it. Like, that was my whole interaction.
And the symptoms that your housemate told them you'd suffered, they didn't even question them.
They didn't even answer him. And I'm not, like, I know you shouldn't judge on things like this, but I wasn't dressed like I was going out to a nightclub.
It shouldn't matter, but those are the things
that people judge you on. And I was so judged, I think, because of my age, because of my gender. I don't know. I was just judged. I don't feel like if I was 40 or 50 that they might have at least responded.
They just thought you were a drunken young one.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Who came in to sleep it off. Yeah.
And the thing is, when you get spiked, I never had anything like that before happen to me ever, but you're so compliant. You just say yes to everything. You just want to do what everybody else wants you to do, you know? And I kept saying all night, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. And like when my housemate said, lie down, I lied down. When he said, go to the toilet, I went to the toilet. But that's really dangerous for other people who weren't in the situation when they had a housemate to look after them.
Yes.
Like something bad could have happened to somebody.
Yes.
Like they could have been abused. Somebody could have said, let's go back to my house, and I would have gone.
And you can't even report this now because...
I can't report it because they didn't take any tests or any... Like if somebody had raped me or something, God forbid... I wouldn't be able to report it because they didn't even answer me when I told them what had happened to me. Like, that's not, you know.
Mm.
What are you meant to do in that situation? Like, should I have gone to the guards, maybe? Should I have gone to, like, if it ever happened to me again, I wouldn't go back to A&E anyway.
That's a tough old story, Joan. And it is, you were misjudged because I would have thought, and I'm only saying, I would have thought this. You know, my daughter now is likes to drink and she goes out with her friends, and if someone spiked her, I would tear down walls to find out what she'd spiked, what she was spiked with, because you don't know how your body's going to react.
Yeah. And I was on the fence about telling my parents, but I did tell them the next day because people in work knew kind of what had happened. So, you know, it was feasible at some stage that they might have heard anyway. So I felt I should tell them. And my dad was so angry. Like, he was demanding me to say what bar I was in and all this. And obviously I didn't want to because I knew that he'd drive down there and say, like, it happened to my little girl. Like, why didn't you? But it wasn't the bar's fault. Like, I was actually treated way worse in A&E. Like, you know, it was just one of those situations where you kind of wanted a parent there to say, are you going to do any tests? Are you actually going to do anything? Or should we just go home? Which is what we did in the end, you know?
Well, listen, and I'm glad you're okay now.
Thank you. And I know in general, like, hospitals are just a horrendous place to work. And 99% of nurses are salt of the earth. But in this case, like, the lady that I had particularly looking after me just judged me and made it worse.
Joan, listen, thanks for your call and for telling us your story. Appreciate it. 1850-715-996. Frank on Twitter says, I was spiked once. Horrible feeling. Happens so fast and there's nothing you can do. You're just gone. And I'm 6'2". Yes, I agree with Joan. One minute you're there, the next minute you're gone. And like she said, she was an when she came round after the initial collapse, she was so compliant, she would do anything that anybody asked her to do. Now, it's just lucky that her housemate, who was a damn good friend, went with her, minded her, took care of her. But she was so compliant, she could have gone with anybody. 1850-715-996.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world. Cork's 96 FM.
Text the Opinion Line now. This is what you came for. 083-396-96-96. Cork's 96 FM.
Now, if you've ever been spiked, then Joan's description of what happened to her frightened the life out of you. She literally drained her drink, and within seconds, she was in the loo, and she lost control over her body, and she was being sick everywhere. Michael Guerin, good morning.
Morning, PJ.
That's probably the most scary description of being spiked that I've ever heard. Literally, it took hold of her in seconds. What kind of things do people use to do that?
Generally speaking, the two substances that are used in drink spiking are either stimulants or sedatives. Stimulants would be things like GHB, ecstasy, in extreme cases, ketamine or maybe MDMA. And then in the sedative category, you see things like benzos, sleeping tablets. Rohypnol was the one we heard a lot about a number of years back. It's still around and it's still traded on the streets.
Yeah.
And based on the description that the young lady gave, she had a terrible experience. But because she was so compliant, I would be inclined to think it was probably one in the sedative category that she got.
Right.
Because the stimulants tend to make people agitated, paranoid, they have hallucinations and that kind of thing. Sickness and illness and lack of coordination and stuff like that would be common across the two groups.
Yes. And she said she felt she was very compliant. She did what she was asked to do. And she felt she'd little or no control over her body. All she wanted to do was lie down.
Yes. Yes. So again, it was something that had a very calming effect on her. She wanted to lie down. And worryingly, as she quite pointed out herself there in the interview, she was very compliant and probably in the wrong situation, might be very open to suggestion.
Yes.
So I suppose that's the concerning thing. The reason why she felt ill probably as quickly as she did is that these substances that are added to drinks are always done in either liquid or powder form. So they are very readily available to be taken up by the person's system when they take them. And we need to remember the vast majority of spiking victims are people that don't do drugs in the first case, so they have no tolerance.
Yes.
So if you take somebody that's habitually using and you give them X amount of something, they're perfectly okay. But somebody who has never used it before, if you give them a little amount in the drink and they're not aware of it, bang, they're gone in seconds.
What's annoying her terribly, Michael, is that they didn't test her for anything in the hospital, which means she has no way of pursuing this.
Yes, and I find it, I've no medical expertise, but I find it very puzzling to see that how somebody can be treated when the medical team haven't first attempted at least to ascertain the substance they have taken, which is very strange to me.
Mm. They just seem to have treated her as if she was plastered and let her sleep it off.
Yes, yes. And but you see, in on the other side of the coin there, PJ, and I'm not defending the indefensible in terms of the treatment that she received in the A&E, but the staff in A&E are absolutely bombarded with people every weekend in varying degrees of extreme intoxication.
Yes.
And in a lot of cases, these people are coming in with this self-inflicted, and they claim that their drink was spiked.
Yes.
So, again, I'm not defending rudeness or bad manners or anything like that. I'm merely saying I spent a night 4 years ago in Limerick Regional Hospital A&E with my mother. And I mean, 60 to 70% of the people who were in there at midnight were either drunk or under the influence of drugs, and that was the reason why they were in the A&E in the first place.
Yeah.
And they were taking scarce staff and scarce expertise and resources away from people like my mother who were extremely ill.
Yes.
And I remember being quite resentful about it at the time.
Yeah, hard to blame, yeah.
You know? So, I mean, in their defence, like, you know, if somebody comes in intoxicated, they put them there and they sleep it off, or whatever the case might be, they're probably so overrun that there may not be many other options.
Which comes back to what Chris Luke was saying when we started this conversation. Michael, the clock has caught me for no reason other than time. I'll end it there. Thank you very much. Michael Geeran from Brewery, a great expert in all these things. Spiking, that's it. I must say, Joan's experience of what happened to her is graphic and it is frightening. And it could be you, or Lord knows it could be me tomorrow.
You're listening to a repeat of the 96FM Opinion Line. Phone and text lines are now closed. The Opinion Line, yeah. With PJ Coogan. This is what you came for. 1850-715-996.
Here's a text that came in during the news. Hi, PJ. Many years ago, my drink was spiked. I fell and my shoulder is frozen ever since. That came in from Susan. That's interesting. Permanent damage. Nora says, I was admitted into the CUH. The coffee machine was broken. The girl was very nice. She made me a cup of tea at the height of all the bother. An awful lot of goodness out there too. And I don't think anybody is questioning that for a second, Nora. John the Postman asks, was it one of the people that Joan was with that they did it to her? She has no idea. She has no idea. And another caller wanted to know why she never named the bar, or indeed the hospital. Well, she did mention the hospital, it was CUH, and she said she didn't want to name the bar because she's no blame on the bar. She's not blaming the bar, so therefore she didn't want to name them. 1850-715-996. Now, if you have small ears in the kitchen or the living room or wherever you happen to be listening or in the car, you might just need to turn us down for the next maybe 10 minutes and stick on some cartoons for the kids or something like that, because we're going to talk about pornography. And just, it might be a little bit inappropriate. It's your own decision, but just putting it out there for you. There's an article appeared this week on the Jumpstart Your Confidence website. Now, we talked to Eileen from Jumpstart Your Confidence quite regularly on the show, but she posted up an article from Australia where they did a survey of 600 young women and girls, a group called Plan Australia. And it was into the survey was on the influence of pornography in the lives of young people. And some of the things they found were quite frightening. And pornography, for any parent should know at this stage, it is more freely available now than it ever was. And if you take the one social media platform that young people, kids use now more than any, is Snapchat. It's the big business. Snapchat is awash with pornography. Awash with it. So is Twitter. Absolutely awash with pornography. That's what got me thinking. But I read down the article and it's very disturbing. Very disturbing. And what it effectively says is this survey of 600 women and girls in Australia found that young men are now learning their sexual behaviour from watching pornography and are trying to do to young women what they see men doing in that self-same pornography. And that is scary. Eileen, good morning.
Hi, good morning, PJ. How are you?
Good. That does sum it up. They're learning. Young kids, young boys are learning sex through watching porn, and it is frightening.
Yeah, well, it is a huge growing concern, I suppose, when I'm working with kids in schools. And, you know, before we start, as usual, we're not talking about everybody.
No.
We're talking about set groups within certain age groups. Here, I know the surveys in Australia, but there's no doubt we have a lot of these issues in our own country, and it's something that I think we really need to start focusing on. I suppose in my experience professionally, the last 8 to 10 years, we've seen a huge change in relationships, you know, in teenage relationships up to young 20s and that as well. And actually, it gets a lot older, but anyway, we'll talk about the younger group. I suppose we said before, PJ, people used to learn by buying a magazine or whatever, the basics of what they wanted to know, which is natural progression and interest. But nowadays, youngsters go online and they're finding out the most horrendous, explicit information. And it, unfortunately, it begins to normalise certain acts that aren't actually or shouldn't be normalised. And I just think we need to really speak to our kids. I know it's a subject that a lot of parents will say, oh, the kids will never listen to me, they don't want to hear it from me. But, you know, by showing them articles to read, by maybe looking at different programmes that are on, and there are some good programmes on educating the kids. And then again, I do think under the school umbrella, we have got to educate our kids on what's normal and what isn't. And I suppose essentially it all does come back to respect and value on oneself that we have to start instilling from home at a very young age. Because what social media does, in my opinion, whether it's to do with sex, pornography, violence, everything negative, it normalises an amount of stuff out there that is so not normal. And to be fair to the kids and the teens, you know, they're getting this bombarded at them daily. So it's quite natural that a certain amount of stuff does become normalised unless they have someone else that they respect and they look up to who can balance the information they're getting online. Because otherwise they're using this online forum as their adult, as their information, you know. And so we do have to help them by balancing them in a very realistic way, not talking down to them, not preaching. We've got to sit down and talk to them, whether it's through school or at home, on the realities of what's happening.
See, for a parent, you're faced with this thing. There's a certain time in your youngster's life, between about the age of 14 and 17, where if you tell them what day it is, they'll check. Because you're an owl fogey, and what could you possibly know? They're not going to listen to
you. I totally understand that. You know? Because I have four daughters myself, believe me. But sometimes I think if you're lucky, maybe if you've over older siblings or cousins that they look up to, you might have godparents that they look a bit cooler than their parents, even though they might be age relatives. But just look around and see if there's somewhere else. Some parents actually can talk about this. It depends on the relationship you have. But again, giving them articles, I suppose basically we really have to teach them respect and value on themselves to a huge degree from an early age, and also the fact that what we see online is not necessarily real. Like, educationally wise, I think we have to look at getting, you know, people who kids can relate to. There are certain people can work with kids and certain people can't. Certain people are trained to teach kids, certain people are trained to educate them on these kinds of subjects. Yeah. And there is a difference. You know, we could all have the same amount of information, but who delivers the information and the way it's delivered will tell you whether a child is going to listen or not.
One of the findings of this was, and this is the one that I would think that parents need to take into their minds, sexual bullying and harassment are part of daily life for many girls growing up as part of the digital generation. Young girls are speaking out more and more about the practices of links with pornography. Pornography is moulding and conditioning the sexual behaviour and attitudes of boys, and girls have no resources to deal with it. That's frightening.
It is frightening. And I mean, you know, if you look back 20 years ago, I know we didn't have social media, but at the same time, the idea that 12, 13s, and there are plenty of 12, 13s posting a photo of themselves either in bikinis or underwear or less, because they think it's okay. Some of them, in an innocent way, think it's okay. I know our label and are quite happy to do it. But at the same time, do they understand the implications of that? I mean, we're interviewing straight up on Facebook.
Like, the industry, the porn industry is huge. It's global. It's a multi-billion dollar racket. You're never going to be able to ban it. So we have to accept that it's there and teach our children to be ready for it.
Absolutely. We have to.
Is that our job, or is that the school system's job?
Well, I think ideally it's obviously a parent's job to educate their kids on all of this. But as we've said already, it is a tough subject. It's something that they mightn't take in from us. But I do strongly believe, and I've experienced it, that if parents do speak to them, and then if it's reiterated in school and reiterated maybe somewhere else that the kids respect, then it does all sink in. The kids listen to their parents. They mightn't act like they listen, but believe me, they do listen. It is a parent job, but I think government-wise, health-wise, we do, as a country, have a responsibility to educate our kids in a world that's changing so rapidly, because I feel terribly sorry for them.
Yeah.
They have to be educated and, you know, not pussyfoot around it. This has to be hit between the eyebrows. I mean, when I talk to 16, 17, because I'm not a teacher, I can actually speak quite openly to the kids, and they are so appreciative. They're crying out for support in this area. So I think under the school umbrella, we do need to look at implementing something. And I'm not knocking teachers in any regard, but a lot of teachers aren't trained to work in this area and talk about this subject because it's difficult. Mm. But the kids need people who are very comfortable talking about it, who they might respect in a different way, who they listen to.
Like, we're talking all the time about...
It's a huge growing problem.
Yeah, we're talking all the time about the concept of consent. And you can speak to the four walls about consent, and then they can open Snapchat and see something where consent didn't even come into the equation.
Yeah, it's true. And I suppose, you know, we have to remember, obviously, there's a lot of kids don't even entertain this kind of behaviour. But I think at the bottom line, and I know I go on about confidence and self-esteem.
No, but they're all exposed to it, Eileen. Whether they'll entertain
they
it, they're exposed to it.
Yeah. They are exposed to it, there's no doubt. And, you know, I don't want to scaremonger parents, because to be fair to the kids, this is the world they live in. We can't cut them off. I mean, I had a parent saying, I want to protect my child, I'm not going to let them on. But at a certain age, this is the way they socialise. It was like us on a telephone 25 years ago, do you know what I mean? We have to educate them how to live in it. We can't pretend it's not there, because this is the world they live in. But we have to educate them, put in the boundaries, keep an eye on what's going on, and teach our kids respect and value on themselves. Is one of the most important things we will ever teach them.
All right. Eileen, thank you. Jumpstartyourconference.com is Eileen's website. It's always worth a look. And that article is up there about that survey in Australia. It was 600 girls, but it applies equally to boys, the things that they found. And it is frightening. I think we have a link. Have we a link up to it, guys? Just so people can read it for themselves. 1850 715 996. We've talked many times with Eileen Sexton from Hot Press about matters sexual and matters to do with pornography. And Eileen makes the point that it's education is needed. We need to teach our children, and the school system needs to accept that we have to talk about these difficult things with teenagers. And Anne has been saying exactly that, and we'll chat with her next. 1850 715 996.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world. Cork's 96 FM.
The Big Drive Home with Wayne Hilton. Cork's 96 FM.
Hi, this is Wayne, and I'll be broadcasting live from Turner's Cross this Thursday from 4 till 7 for the UEFA Europa League match Cork City versus AEK Larnaca. We'll be bringing you a taste of the atmosphere before that big match with some great giveaways. That's the Big Drive Home this Thursday, live from Turner's Cross from 4 till 7.
Wayne Hilton, weekdays 4 p.m.
With the new Peugeot 3008 SUV, European Car of the Year 2017. Never has an SUV gone so far.
Cork's 96 FM. Call the Opinion Line.
This is what you came for.
1850-715-996. Cork's 96 FM.
And as I say, Anne Sexton's been writing for many years about sexual matters for Hot Press magazine. Always good to talk to her on the show. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Good. This is a significant piece of research coming from Australia. And I guess any parent of teenagers will read it with some worry.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think anyone who's got teenagers is going to be worried about porn and about their children looking at porn. And the very fact of the matter is that most kids have their first introduction to porn at around the age of 11, 12, 13, which is obviously much too young. Mm.
The other thing, of course, is that the social media world, Twitter, Snapchat in particular, they're both awash with porn. Facebook is a bit more careful, you might say.
Yes, I mean, Facebook obviously is very careful about removing nudity to the extent that they remove quite innocuous pictures of women breastfeeding, but at the same time are less likely to remove violent images where women have been beaten or looks like women may have been sexually assaulted, which is bizarre to me. Mm-hmm. But yes, there's a lot of porn on social media, and it is almost impossible as a parent for you to stop your child from seeing it, which means the only way to go is education.
Yeah. We have to teach them to be ready for it, to be ready for what they might see. But that's not a conversation you want to have with your kids.
Oh, absolutely not. But I don't think any parent really likes to have the sex talk with their child. But it's absolutely necessary, and it's, you know, a key a parenting moment. But we absolutely need better sex education in schools, and that sex education should absolutely include discussions about porn as well. And children should be taught the difference between porn sex and real sex.
Yeah.
Now, if you're a grown-up man or woman with sexual experience, then you obviously have something that you can compare porn to. But if you're a teenager with little to zero sexual experience, then obviously you don't have that comparison, and you don't necessarily know the difference between fantasy sex and real sex.
And you find something on Twitter and you look at it and you go, okay, that's what sex is.
Exactly, because you don't know the difference. And you can't blame young people for turning to porn for education if they're not getting it elsewhere. And I think even if they are getting sex education, it's so ubiquitous and it's everywhere. And, you know, teenagers are curious, so they're probably going to watch it anyway. But at least if we can teach them the difference between porn sex and real sex, that's one thing. And I also think we need to be teaching the idea of consent from a very young age.
Mm.
I don't necessarily mean you're teaching four-year-olds about sexual consent, but you can teach them that you don't roughhouse with another child without their permission, or you don't take someone's toys without their permission. The idea that you have to get permission from people before you do anything that affects them is something you can teach children from a very young age, all of which will play into their attitudes towards sex as they get older.
Something else we need to start teaching too is that it is not okay for a boy to say, send me a picture of your private parts.
Yes, obviously. Now this is...
They're sending stuff to each other, and it would frighten you.
Now there's two problems. Well, there's actually more than two problems here, but on the one hand, any child that requests another child to send them nude images is requesting child pornography, which is a crime. Any young person who actually sends a picture of her breasts or his genitals to somebody who's underage is also creating child pornography, which is
they don't know this, you see.
They don't know this. This is why education is absolutely essential.
I remember my own primary school and secondary school. Now, it's quite a while ago, but anything to do with sex and relationships was either judiciously avoided and that chapter was skipped and we'd be told, oh, we'll come back to it, and we never did, or it just wasn't done.
Yes, and the thing is, ignorance is not bliss. Just because you don't teach children about sex doesn't mean they're not going to be curious about it, doesn't mean they're not going to, you know, they're not going to grow up and have hormones, because all of that happens. Now, I don't know if you saw, there was a survey out recently which found that Irish sex education schools, the majority of students believe it is inadequate. 76% of college students surveyed by NUI Galway said that their sexual health education was not fit for purpose. So that means we do have something of a crisis here, and we do need to take that seriously.
Because as this article says, violent pornography is infiltrating relationships in Australia. If it's happening in Australia, it's happening here.
Okay, I do think they're a little bit... that article, I think the way it was written was... there was a bit of scaremongering going on. I don't think we should assume that all young teenage boys across Ireland are little potential rapists who are about to, you know, do terrible things to 12-year-old girls. I don't think that's fair on young Irish boys, and I don't think that's quite what's happening. But I do think that a lot of them have seen porn, and we should absolutely educate them because of that.
And thanks as always for your time.
Thanks very much, PJ.
And Sexton from Hot Press Magazine. And that is where we're going to close that one down. So if they were inside in the other room now watching Dora the Explorer, you can tell them come out again.
All right.
Just wanted to bring that to you and warn you of the dangers of having small ears around. They'll discover it for themselves in the fullness of time. 1850-715-996. I've been talking since 9 o'clock about this Argos table. There's a front page on the UK edition of The Sun today. The menace of the exploding Argos tables is the front page headline on The Sun. It's quite hilarious, but it is serious. There is a make of table sold in Argos. It is the... I have it written down here now and I can't find it again, but these tables, glass-topped patio tables, are actually expanding and blowing up, exploding, shattering in the sunshine. And they've had them all over the UK for the last number of years. And they're trying to get Argos in the UK now to recall this particular make of table. Now, Argos have been contacted by a number of different people in the UK and they haven't done it yet. But just to warn you, it's happening in Devon and happening all over the UK. If anybody bought this particular make of table in the UK, don't leave it out in the blazing sunshine. And we're hopefully in now for another couple of days. Miami is one of the names of the sets. And there was also a Sicily was one of the sets that were blowing up. So if you have bought as a glass-topped table from Argos in the last couple of months and it's out on the patio in the sunshine, just be careful of it. Because all over the UK, these things have been shattering in the sunshine. Just bringing you for what it's worth. 1850-715-996.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world. Cork's 96 FM.
Text the Opinion Line now. This is what you came for. 083-396-96-96. Cork's 96 FM.
Yeah, that table, the offending table, the Argos Sicily, which is reportedly blowing up and shattering all over Britain. It is on sale at Argos in Mahon Point for €285. I just looked it up on the interweb. So they're here. So be wary of them. Be wary of them. 1850-715-996. Now, we're talking about drinks being spiked and Joan's experience of having her drink spiked. Susan, good morning.
Good morning, PJ. How are you?
Good. Your drink was spiked.
It was spiked, about 10, maybe 12 years ago.
Right. What happened?
I had two drinks. I was with my sister-in-law, my brother, and a friend of mine, and we came out of the bar and I fell on my shoulder. So I went off to CUH then and they kept me in for the night. They put pins in. Then the next day they took them out. And after that then they said they couldn't do any more. So I went from specialist to specialist all over the place. Got injections and the whole lot. So in the end then I borrowed money then to go to a chiropractor thinking he might be able to help me. No, that didn't work either. So then I would. My doctor sent me over to a specialist in South Infirmary, Mr. Pat Fleming.
Yeah.
So he took my shoulder scan, and he said, "Yes." He said, "All your bones in your shoulder are gone." And he said, "On top of that, you've arthritis now as well."
Wow.
So he said.
And that was from a fall that you got because your drink had been spiked.
That was fall I got. My drink being spiked.
Wow.
So he told me then to go home and think about getting a replacement.
Yes.
So I came back and he said, come back in 2 months. So when I went back in 2 months' time, he says, look, I don't think I'll do it. And I said, why? I said, I want to get it done. He said, but it's only 50-50. But I said, it doesn't make any difference because I said, my shoulder is dead anyway now.
Yeah.
I can't use it. I can't use my shoulder, PJ. It takes me, if I have a shower in the morning, it takes me 20 minutes to get dressed.
Wow.
Yeah, 20 minutes. No, I asked for home, not home help, I asked for someone to come in personal care, you know, can we help?
Yeah, yeah.
And she said no. And I asked her why she said no. She said your doctor's letter wasn't good enough.
Who said that?
The head nurse.
Oh, yeah, okay. Mm. So?
So now, there I am on PJ with a morphine patch and painkillers and a frozen shoulder.
Over spike drink?
Over spike drink, yeah.
Wow. And you've no idea, obviously, who spiked you.
No idea.
Wow, that's a frightening tale. Susan, listen, thanks for the call.
Okay, Peter. Thank you. Bye.
1850-715-996. Got a drink spiked. Got a fall as a result of it, and now has a permanently frozen shoulder, which is a very, very painful thing. I know, because I know someone who's had one. For years, and they did get the replacement. They did get the joint stuff that you can do. 1850-715-996. I don't know if you saw this last night on the telly. This was going all over Twitter last night, like nobody's business, because the biggest fight, it is the biggest pay-per-view sports event I think you can ever, that's ever been put together. Conor McGregor, the notorious Conor McGregor, and Floyd Mayweather, 12 times world boxing champion at 5 different weight levels. Mayweather is a legend in the sport of boxing. They are to face off in the ring on the 26th of August in a boxing ring under boxing rules. It won't be MMA, it'll be boxing rules. And that is going to be a huge pay-per-view event on the 26th of August in the States. And they had their first press conference last night. And it just went a little bit like this.
There's no other way about it. His little legs, his little core, his little head. I'm going to knock him out inside 4 rounds, mark my words.
I don't give a f- if it's a ring. I don't give a f- if it's an octagon. Put me in there and I'm gonna kick ass.
Don't be talking.
You line him up and I knock him down like bowling pins. And August 26th, I'm gonna knock this down too.
Yeah, right.
That was just the flavor of it. But it wasn't so much about the press conference as about the suit. Conor McGregor was wearing a pinstriped suit and a pink tie. The suit looked fabulous. And then you got the close up. It was gold pinstripes. And it wasn't a stripe, it was a word. And the word was F off. F off, F off, F off, F off, F off, F down through the suit. Hundreds and hundreds of times. Not something you'd be inclined to wear to the Style Awards, Michael Mulcahy. Good morning.
Morning, PJ. I think not. But everybody... has a unique style, I think, Conor McGregor. I actually think it was F-U.
It was, yeah, they're correct to me.
Yeah. Which obviously had a purpose. But I think his style is certainly unique. And I think when you've got a personality like that and when you've perhaps an ego like that, you can wear certain things like that. I'm not quite sure we'd have too many people in Cork walking down the Mall or Patrick Street with that on them. But who knows? And I think with the changing face of men's clothing and the image, I think, of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, there's very little that's unacceptable today for men to wear.
Yeah.
And that's actually a good thing, because I think it takes us away from, as we might say in the country, the beige clothes. Mm-hmm. And when men, I think, have a little bit of style about them, it gives perhaps a bit more personality to themselves.
There's style and there's style in it, though, Michael. I mean, if someone turned up at the New Yorker Style Awards in November wearing that suit, would they get in the door?
Oh, I think they'd get in the door, certainly. They might even win an award for it. So let's put the message out to all the men there, but in particular to the ladies of the men, because it's always the ladies that inspire the men from what I can see at the Style Awards, that anything is acceptable. And I'm sure maybe Pam O'Regan in Seville or some of the other gentlemen outfitters around town would be very open to accommodating our men if they wish to have something personal.
Well, you mentioned Pam, and she's on the other line. Also, in the course of that press conference, McGregor mentioned that he is looking at bringing out his own suit range, which means that that suit he was wearing last night might well be on the rails soon enough, complete with its most unique form of pinstripe. Pam, good morning.
Hey, good morning, PJ. How are you?
Good. Would you stock it?
Would we stock it? We'd stock anything. Anything that's unique and controversial. But sure, isn't it fantastic? He's a master of marketing, isn't he, really? But I think it goes with his personality, doesn't it, you know? And I think it's great. It's just great to have people doing things that are different and their own style. You know, yeah. We may not agree with it, we may not wear it, or we may not particularly like it. But yeah. Look, it's all good, isn't it?
Well, is it,
if we
though?
Were all going around,
is it, though? Same, it I mean, because he's Irish, yeah. And because he's there.
And he is. You know. And I mean, if you think back to all the great sports people, where are all the inspirational people, that the likes of the Muhammad Ali's and these people that were just, you know, yeah. They entertained us and they were super. So, you know, we need people like that in the world, PJ. Our world can be a bit grey and dull at times.
I know, but can you imagine know? If the Cork hurlers lined out in the All-Ireland semi-final with FU emblazoned down the side of the red jumper, the red jersey.
I think actually what they'd be putting on there is a zanger.
Yeah, but... Do you think it could start a trend, though?
It could do, it could. Sure, you'd be amazed at what can come out of these things, you know? Why not?
So you'd stock
it. It's great to see guys... getting so inspirational, you know, and definitely we find and we have found that guys are just, they're fantastic. They're game for anything. You know, the days of men being dull and boring is gone, you know. Yeah. So it's good. It's great. And why not see people taking an interest, doing something different. And as I say, looking on the lighter side of life, PJ, isn't that what
But you're not even a little bit put off by the phrase used.
Not particularly. You know, we're all, I suppose, you know, we're all... adult fear, let's say, you know. But I know, maybe if my son came in the door wearing it, I'd probably be slightly taken aback, but, you know.
Well, do you remember the French Connection t-shirts that had the plain white t-shirt that had FCUK across the front of them, right?
I remember
years ago walking into my dad's kitchen wearing this t-shirt, and I don't think the poor man is still over it.
He's
not over it yet, like.
And I remember in my misspent youth buying this absolutely what I thought fabulous pure white, it was a long sleeve t-shirt. And there were these two wonderful ducks flying on the front of it. And it said, Fly United. But they were bold ducks, PJ. I won't tell you what.
yeah, I know.
So there you are. We all go through these phases, don't we?
Well, let's put the ultimate question. Michael, would you wear that suit? A man known for his range of... You must have a wardrobe bigger than my house.
I'm not sure about that, now, but I'd certainly wear a suit with some writing on it. And I think when you look at perhaps what's happening in the wedding industry here in Ireland, I'm sure there's a market out there perhaps for guys to wear a suit, get a bespoke suit made in the likes of Seville, and have the name, their own name, and the bride's name on that suit as a very personalised suit for their day. Discreet, though. And I know the
That's
word...
That's what we do, yeah. We do that, Michael, yeah. Absolutely.
Why not? They do the beautiful runners up the church, you know, with the name of the bride and groom. And why shouldn't a man wear a suit with his bride's name or husband's name or whatever the case is? I think we've moved well beyond that. Would I wear it? Actually... As you saw,
I think you would, Michael. If I took you out for a drink, of course you would.
Well, if I was going with Pam O'Regan, of course I could wear anything, you see, because she'd make me look good anyway. So it wouldn't matter what I'd wear. But I did wear this New Yorker suit to the launch of New Yorker Style Awards recently, and it's a bit bold maybe for me, but anything goes. I think we're all we've all grown up a little bit here. I think it would look better on you, though, PJ.
The whole idea is to get up close and personal, you see, because you must get up close to read it, you know.
That's the key.
You'd certainly be the topic of conversation at any event you were at. Listen, Pam from Savills and Michael Mulcahy, thank you very much. 1850-715-996. I know that Conor McGregor's number one fan must have absolutely been weak for the suit. Weak, only Laura, hello.
Hi, PJ. How are you, my darling?
What an horrible, arrogant thing to get sewn into the lining of your suit.
PJ, as if we haven't all wanted to wear a suit that said F-U on it. I swear to God.
It didn't just say F-U. It had the whole word.
It gave me a lot of hassle. do you know what now, PJ? Straight away, right, what you said there about if the Cork curling team wore it, for God's sake. I am absolutely sick of the Cork curling team being, they're back, thank God, but being trotted out as these icons, right? Of course, they're icons or whatever, but I said it to you the last time. Give me Connor any day with his big, brave, bold head telling the world that he is the best, rather than all these lads mumbling about the team effort and sure, like, there's a great day out and we're delighted. No, no, no. Connor all the way. He is my number one inspiration.
Well, when Floyd Merriweather baits seven colours out of Minogus.
Mayweather, PJ,
not Merriweather. Mayweather. When he beats the seven bells out of him in August.
Sean, my darling, he's going to win. And sure, it doesn't matter anyway, because as Connor said last night, getting a big old paycheck. He's doing it for his beautiful new baby boy, Connor Jr., and his beloved partner, Dee, and he will be out there and he'll be laughing. I tell you what, right? Mark my words, Connor has this fight and about three more, and then he'll retire in a blaze of glory. That's what I reckon.
Yeah.
And I'll be riding that chariot with him.
Kevin says on Twitter, if anybody pays €25 to watch this farce, they deserve a good solid slap.
Would Kevin ever cheer off €25? I'd pay way more than €25.
Well, here's the thing. Apparently the dearest pay-per-view in the States to see it in high definition will cost $99.
Perfect. No bother. I'd nearly do it. I'd nearly fly over there if it wasn't for the fact that I might give birth at the side of the ring.
Are you going to have are you going to refer to McGregor in the name of the baby?
Oh, I am not indeed. Excuse me. The child will be named after his grandparents. No, but sure, look it. I am.
Will we get some nice things stitched into the wording on the baby grow?
We surely will.
Get your special
will.
Baby grow.
My daughter does already refer to him as her Uncle Connor, and she realises that he's a very important figure in our lives. And he's just this usual. Who are they all talking about this morning, PJ? They're talking about Connor. They're not talking about Floyd in his little tracksuit looking all sad and silent on the stage. Connor now, I tell you what. And Floyd made a mistake last night because Floyd said he'd fight him with 4-ounce gloves. Oh, Floydie. Don't be getting cocky now, Floydie, because my money's on McGregor. I am unashamedly the only person that thinks that Connor can win. And I think he can. Me and Coach Kavanagh, we think he can win.
Well, Coach Kavanagh has to.
Well, Coach Kavanagh is a genius in his own right. So look at, I tell you, it's all to play for. It isn't over. It isn't clear cut at all. It isn't clear cut at all. I'll be talking to you down the 27th of August, PJ, about his great win.
Right. All right, Laura. No doubt who you're supporting. Take care. Thanks. 1850-715-996. Now, the press conference was a lot longer than the 30 seconds odd I played there. I just played it again for the crack. Hang on.
There's no other way about it. His little legs, his little core, his little head. I'm going to knock him out inside 4 rounds. Mark my words.
I don't give a f- if it's a ring. I don't give a f- if it's an octagon, put me in there and I'm going to kick ass.
Don't be talking.
You line him up and I knock him down like bowling pins. And August 26th, I'm going to knock this down too.
Yeah, right.
You see, I've gotten over how I used to react to those press conferences, because I know it's just an act and a panto. It's all showbiz. But it was very funny, wasn't it, Jonathan? Good morning.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, to be honest with you, I thought the press conference there, I thought it would be funnier. I thought it was kind of boring, but I don't know if you've seen it, but you should look out for the other press conference he did afterwards, and Floyd Mayweather Sr. Was in the crowd, and he was just shouting at him. It was absolutely hilarious. The both of them had a shouting match at each other.
I must have a look for that.
Oh, it was absolutely hilarious altogether, like. But, as you were saying, Saul, pantomime all and act, everything he does, every word that comes out of his mouth, everything he does is all for the McGregor brand, and he's a marketing genius. He's a multimillionaire. 4 years ago, he had absolutely nothing on the dole. He, probably one of Ireland's greatest ever sports people now, right?
You have to hand it to the lad. Like, he really has built himself up into an international megastar.
Yeah, he's known worldwide. He's 24th on the Forbes Rich List all within 4 years. It's unbelievable.
I don't like his sport, but I can't but admire how he's done it.
Yeah, it's not for everybody. Hurling's not for everybody. MMA is not for everybody, but unbelievable what the guy has done within the space of 4 years.
Do you think that Mayweather will beat him?
It's very hard to call, but I don't know.
Like, he has concrete blocks for fists, and he's proved that more than once.
Who would you go for?
I think, but under the Queensbury rules, as they say.
Yeah.
Under the Queensbury rules, when he can't use his legs and he can't use his throws and he can't do that kind of thing, I think he'll have an awful job getting past Mayweather.
Yeah. Oh, he will, all right, and the fact too, like, McGregor will actually find it very hard not to throw an elbow or something. He could do it instinctively,
exactly,
by accident.
That's it.
Like,
that's
but.
It. It'll be interesting to see is the one scrap of this kind that I'm actually going to sit up late and watch. Thanks, Jonathan. 1850 715 996. Remember earlier on, we read out Hawkeye's email about the Linfield match, Celtic versus Linfield in the European qualifiers. Paul wants to talk about it. I reckon it'll probably round off the show today. I get to Paul next. 1850 715 996.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world. Cork's 96 FM.
The Big Drive Home with Wayne Hilton. Cork's 96 FM.
I'll bring you the very latest Cork news from around the world, trending celebrity news. If you're out and about, all your essential Cork travel news, then I could be giving you the best news as I make lots of €1,000 cash calls. Join me weekday afternoons from 4 as we go home together and play Cork's biggest hits with the best variety.
Wayne Hilton, weekdays 4 p.m.
With the new Peugeot 3008 SUV, European Car of the Year 2017. Never has an SUV gone so far.
Cork's 96 FM. Call the Opinion Line.
This is what you came for.
1850-715-996. Cork's 96 FM.
John wants to know, why would PJ want to watch a barbaric sport like this? John, I don't particularly like MMA, but I am old and have always been a boxing fan. And for that reason, I want to watch this one because I'm interested in it. That's just it. Maureen in Clan says, hi PJ, I was about 24, had a navy blue t-shirt, which I thought looked very bare. So I got a white felt tip pen and wrote on the front, "Men at Work Down Under," and an arrow pointing down. They were the days. Yeah, around the same time, Maureen, I used to have a t-shirt that had two arrows on it. One pointing up, pointing towards the head, the man. The other one pointing down. And it had the legend. But anyway, 1850-715-996. What Hawkeye wanted to bring up was this match between Glasgow Celtic and Linfield in the European Championship, or the European Champions League qualifiers this week. It's on Friday evening. And Hawkeye said, how can Irish people support Celtic in this match? Irish nationalists. Irish nationalists who believe in a 32-county Ireland. Well, Belfast is in Ireland, so that Linfield are the Irish team. Celtic is in Scotland. Scotland are the British team. So if you're an Irish nationalist and you believe in a 32-county Ireland, then you should be following the Irish team. Linfield. That was Hawkeye's email. It got a colossal response on Facebook, and Hawkeye, I'd say, if they could find out who he was now, would be thrown out of the studio window here. But it's worthy of debate. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, PJ. How are you?
Good. Now, the guy's got a point geographically and politically. If you're an Irish nationalist who believes in a 32-county Ireland, then Belfast is Irish.
Yeah, but I mean, they support Celtic here because it's a big the Catholic influence. I don't think religion has any part in football in the same way that the FA Cup final should be played in the cathedral. It's got no part in it at all. It's football, it's sport.
He also argues, by the way, how many of the Celtic supporters that will be following this game would have been to Mass in a long time.
Probably very, very few. But again, they support Celtic because it's a Catholic team. But again, it's a football team. You support a football team because, you know, you want your football team to win. Now, when United play, I'm a North West Liverpool fan, so I want them to get stuffed by anyone. So I don't support my country's teams in football, so I can't argue too much on that. But again, it's not our religion. It's because I just hate United. Because that's what I was raised to be, you know?
Mm. What would be your club?
Liverpool,
okay.
My home team, you know, I support my home team. But these people from Cork City should support Cork City. If Cork City had the support of the people of Cork, rather than Liverpool, United, Celtic, Arsenal, Chelsea, Man City, it'd be much, much bigger and the more money would be into the club and it'd make the FAI a larger league. But the thing is, they support the English clubs and then they support Cork City when they have a European game or the FAI final, you know, and they support Cork City full stop. And then follow another club after that.
Well, to be fair to Cork City fans now, they have the biggest gate in the league at the moment. And have they had do. For quite some time.
They do, yeah. But you got I walk around Douglas where I live and I see United shirts, Liverpool shirts, Arsenal shirts. I don't see very, very few Cork City shirts. And if I was from Cork City, I would support Cork City and wear their shirt. I wouldn't wear another team's shirt. That's just me.
Do you consider Linfield to be an Irish club?
Well, that's political debate, isn't it? I mean, they are part of the 32 counties, so they're definitely more Irish than Celtic are, if you want to make that point. Celtic are Scottish, therefore they're British. Linfield are an Irish club. They're one of the 32 counties, so yeah, you support Linfield. But again, if Celtic played Cork City tomorrow, what would happen then?
Now, there you go, Paul. And that's a good one to end it on. Thank you very much. 1850-715-996. Paul says, look, Linfield are an Irish club. In a 32-county Ireland. Winnie called to say when they were launching the Sunday World some years back, she had a T-shirt that said, "Are you getting it on Sunday?" Which was a little... Yeah, that was their slogan in the Sunday World for years. I remember when Kevin Maron was the editor of the Sunday World back in the day. God rest Kevin. He was a fantastic television columnist, but he was also the editor of the Sunday World. He was killed in a plane crash, a Beaujolais, a wine trip they used to take every... He was killed. But he came up with that slogan in the early days of the Sunday World. Are you getting it on Sunday? And there was T-shirt. Oh, and there were... Oh, the priests in the altar were appalled. You're right, Winnie. So right you are. Conor McGregor, you know, it's nothing new. It's nothing new. That's it for today. The programme edited by Deirdre O'Shaughnessy, produced and researched by Brenda Dennehy. Your podcast later, repeat in the early hours, and we shall talk to you tomorrow just after 9.